Yes, well, we discussed a number of points yesterday. I mean, I understand that there's some people here who weren't here last night, and we discussed, as usual, the state of the world, which was very depressing. And then after that, we discussed the notion of thought, all these problems which we see have their source is thought, that is, they're symptoms of something deeper, which is the whole process. Thought not merely being intellectual, but it's one process connected, feeling the body, and also really it passes between people and so on. It's all one process all over the world. And we said, okay, I call that a system, you see, a whole system where every part was dependent on every other part. And there's a kind of systemic flaw there, fault, which is pervasive, so that when we see something wrong with a part of the system, we bring another part to bear to try to correct it, but it will just add some more of a very similar trouble. And therefore we find that these troubles throughout the world have been going on for thousands of years, and it's not possible that way to correct them, but they may get worse rather than better in that by doing it that way. Now that was the sort of thing we were discussing. And then finally we said, when you try to look at what's going on inside you when all this is going on, you may get unpleasant feelings, you know, pain or this or that, or fear. And the instinct as well as the whole culture leads you to move away from it, but was saying it was necessary somehow to stay with it, right? That was really what we were discussing at the end, in spite of the difficulty of doing so, that it's really worth doing it, because we may learn something that way about how it all goes. Now, I think that was the sort of the things we discussed yesterday. Now, I thought we'd begin, you know, if people might have a few points they would raise for a little while about yesterday's discussion, and then go on.
I would like to share something that I'm questioning of how my brain works. During your conversation yesterday, I found myself nodding in, I'm assuming, understanding what you were relating to me. Then I would lose you. There would be spaces of not understanding. Then I said I found myself nodding. And when the evening was over, there were spaces of confusion. When I went home and I tried to sleep, I couldn't sleep. Like my mind wasn't in order for me to sleep. I felt it in my body. And finally I gave up and I got up and I took a pad and a pencil and I started writing questions, about 10, 15 questions. And then after that, it was like I felt better. I took a couple of deep breaths and I was falling asleep. And I said to myself, now, why did my brain needed that order even in questioning? And could I have done the same thing by doing sit-ups?
By doing?
Sit-ups.
Oh, sit-ups.
You know, so I'm questioning this. And I'm left with the questioning, why did my brain needed that order in questioning? Or whatever came to that, I didn't decide to question, it just came.
Well, what do you think?
I'm still looking at it, and I'm going to read over the questions and see if there's more questions that come out of those questions.
It's possible, you know, that the whole discussion leaves questions, you know, point, and the mind wants to brings them up, right? You know, if they're puzzled by something, then it won't let you go, right?
But is understanding part of a dialogue? Or is understanding conditioning from my perception?
Well, you could understand at any time, you see.
But would my understanding be different from other people that were shaking their heads at that point?
Well, I don't know. You see, I think that these questions you'll find are not going to lead very far. You see, the major point is whether you are looking into what's going on and perceiving the incoherence and perceiving, you know, and seeing what it means, you see, for yourself, right? Now, if you talk it over with somebody else, then you can find out whether you can perhaps share this or find out why you don't agree, and maybe eventually we'll discuss dialogue later, how that's all to take place, right? Hmm.
Dave, it seemed to me that what she's saying might suggest that this is much more of a psychosomatic process than we tend to realize. We tend to think of it as a mental, simply a mental process, where her report seems to say that there's much more involved than that, and that maybe we have to keep an awareness for that other aspect of it.
Yes, well, is that, would you say that's right, that it's a psychosomatic process that disturbed you? See, that the thoughts, that's what we were saying yesterday, that it's one system of thoughts, the body, the emotions, and also other people are all part of one system. And when you disturb, when you raise questions intellectually, they may affect everything, you see, or vice versa. All of that affects the intellect. So you have to see it as one system. That's the crucial point, because you'll never be able to deal with it if it is one system and you deal with all the parts.
I was trying to fit the concept of addiction into what you were saying. I mentioned it to you last night after we finished. And when I think of addiction, it ranges all the way from, you know, physical addictions to, say, drugs and alcohol, to various kinds of thought addiction. You know, there's positive and there's negative. A negative might be racism. A positive would be this whole raft of books on, like Norman Vincent Peale's, you know, The Power of Positive Thinking. There's a whole legion of thousands of books have been written in this area. Is this the incoherence you're speaking about? Can it be manipulated in positive ways? Is it just a manipulation of this thought process or aberration of it?
Yes, that's still incoherent. You see, if you engage in positive thinking to overcome negative thoughts, but the negative thoughts are still there working, right? Therefore, that's incoherent, right? You see, that it's not enough to just engage in positive thoughts when you have negative thoughts registered, which keep on working, and they'll cause trouble somewhere else. Now, I'll just say a few words about addiction. Now, you see, one point is to say that when you take a substance like morphine, well, it's supposed to cover up certain pain receptors of pain nerves, right? So you don't feel pain. Now, the body has natural substances similar called endorphins, and which do the same, perhaps even better. And in fact, when people say that sometimes soldiers in battle are badly wounded feel no pain, and they have a lot of endorphins, only later do they feel pain. So that has a useful function, you see. But at the same time, it's possible for thoughts, reassuring thoughts, or pleasant thoughts, to also produce endorphins, right? And then you could become addicted to those thoughts in a certain sense, saying, I won't give them up even if they're wrong. You know, I'll believe them to be true. And I can't bear the thought that it's not so. Because that will remove the endorphins, and then the pain will start coming, right? So therefore, you can say addiction, there's a kind of addiction in the thought process which is possible, right? In fact, it's one of the things that holds us. But we'll have to go into that later, that the thought process is physical and chemical, and neurological, neurophysiological, as well as intellectual and emotional, right? So that, in fact, when people do various scans of the brain, see, every time you think, the blood distribution shifts all over the place, and all sorts of changes occur inside the brain waves, electrical waves. And therefore, thought, at the very least, has a certain basis in that neurophysiological process, right? And it can never be separated from it. Now, that's something we have to keep in mind. So the brain, that process is part of the system we're talking about. if you put drugs into the into your body, you have altered the system, right?
If one can mutate the conditioning of thought, is there a space where a new thought comes in that's not conditioning, then we can have a dialogue?
Well, there may be a space. We'll discuss that presently. You see, we can have a dialogue. See, I'm trying to say we can start our dialogue. We're going to discuss that later, but we could start the dialogue without considering that question, you see, and then discover whether there is that space. See, like one point I wanted to emphasize last night was that we don't want to regard this system as an absolutely fixed monolithic thing that was you never break into forever, but it's actually not all that solid, and therefore it has chinks and things and so on, and it lets some things through. Therefore, there is an opportunity to do something, right? You can't control it, but opportunities come up.
What are the effects of the process of the positive thinking to our health? Because isn't it a kind of schizophrenic duality between the facts and between the illusion of the positive thinking?
There's a conflict between you only. See, if somebody wants to engage in positive thinking, it's only because he's already caught up in negative thinking, right? He wants to overcome it with positive thinking. So it will be the best he can hope for is to fill his mind with positive thoughts, so the negative thoughts sort of go into abeyance, right? Right? And don't bother him so much.
But they go to the basement and they stay there.
Yeah. Well, they're waiting.
Yeah.
And when the person somehow feels weak or frightened or something happens, and then out they come, right? You see, he hasn't dealt with those negative thoughts which are registered down there, wherever they are. Therefore, it's at the very least, at the very best, it's not a real solution. And at the worst, it could bring in various endorphins and so on and make you addicted to false thoughts and so on. So it is not a solution, you see. No. You have to get deeper than that. You see, if people say cheer up and so on, you only say cheer up to somebody who is already depressed, right? If he's depressed for some trivial reason, all right, but if he's some other reason it won't go away, then he may cheer up for a while, but it'll come back.
Just to paraphrase what you're saying that we have a psychology in which our well-being is based on having affirming images, and that psychology could never stand up as a real base for well-being, because sooner or later we're going to get negative images.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So as long as we take these images seriously, if we can be cheered up by positive images, we can be depressed by negative ones. As long as we accept images as realities, we're in that trap, right? Because you can't control that image. You see, you may be getting some nice positive images from the people around you, and then along comes somebody who gives you a very negative image, and then the very channels which enable you to feel good because of the positive image enable you to feel bad because of the negative image, right?
It seems that what you're implying is that in order to be able to really be attentive to what is going on with thought, people would have to do in-depth psychological work with the shadow side of the personality or the hungry dogs in the basement of guilt. Psychology is called guilt that is always buried underneath, and we're seeing it in other people.
Well, we have to be let anything come up which is going to come up, you see. And the point is that we'll come to that we have a mechanism for preventing it from coming up. The brain is already conditioned to keep it down, right? We have to find, understand that process.
And that's culturally reinforced.
Yes, it's always being reinforced. And so let's say that things which are relevant would come up in consciousness, but there's a whole mechanism to keep them down.
Even some areas that are very good, for example, some people don't accept anything nice being said to them because they don't see themselves well. They always see good outside in other people, and it's also being repressed in the basement.
Yeah, well, it's all the same whether you say you're wonderful or guilty. You know, it's just one image instead of another. You see, the fundamental process is not different whether you say I'm the greatest and the best, or you say I'm the worst, I'm guilty of everything, right? it's the same process, and the difference is rather secondary. although, because even if you say you're the best, I mean, somebody's going to come along to question that, and so on. And people often, for all sorts of complicated reasons in their past, they find it easier to accept guilt.
So we're questioning the process of either. It's getting underneath that whole process and seeing that any image that we have is not based on reality. So it's not a question of whether I should believe in the negative, or it's understanding the whole thing.
That's right. It's one system, the positive and the negative. You see, this system, the positive and the negative are two sides of the system, right? So anything positive is inevitably negative, and implicitly negative, right? And vice versa. See, let's try to look at that. That there was once an article I saw about the pain-pleasure centers in the brain. Say, in the middle of the brain somewhere, there are the pleasure-pain centers. You know, in animals, they have access to them, and by touching a pleasure center, it showed a picture of a cat very pleased. It was touched by either electrically or chemically. And then by touching it a little stronger, the cat looked very frightened. And by touching it a little stronger still, it looked enraged, but somewhat pleased at the same time. Rage was pleasure, you see. And the point is that and what they said was that every time you stir up pleasure, then all the pain centers around also come in to partially compensate. It's a very complex feeling. Every time you stir up pain, the pleasure centers come in. So there's always a mixture of the two. Now, suppose now that you stub your toe and you feel pain, but meanwhile the pleasure centers are set to work to overcome that, and when the pain goes away, then you feel pleasure. Right? It's left over. Is that clear? Because the pain has died away, the pain centers are quiet for the moment, and then the pleasure centers take a little longer because they were stirred up a little later, right? So you get, one turns into the other. Now fear and security, the sense of fear and the sense of security will turn into each other. But then that gets more complex because you also introduce words about it and saying this is pleasure, that is pain. And we have introduced the way of saying it's either pleasurable or painful. And say if it's not pleasurable, then it's implied that it may be painful. Or if you're losing the pleasure you had it before, then it's implied that there's a loss, there's pain. And on the other hand, the ending of, if you think the pain is over, then you're pleased by it. See, so there's always one, always directly implies the opposite. Right? So therefore, you can't separate the two, neither at the level of chemistry nor at the level of the intellect nor anywhere else. And therefore, the thing is just to say that's the way it is. Right? You see that the attempt to have pleasure always must fail because the pleasure centers will get worn out, and the pain centers, having been stimulated to balance them, will now start to come in strongly. There is no way to get pleasure constantly. And if you were to try to do it, I think you would discover it became painful, you see. So it's always a transitory phenomenon. And we'll discuss all that later, that for the animal, the pleasure-pain reaction is really generally appropriate, but you can already see that for thought it's not, because if you can get pleasure or pain from thought, then that thought, which should be true and correct, that's the criterion for it, is no longer working, right? The criterion is, does it give pleasure or pain, right? Therefore, that thought becomes destructive. So if thought can be determined by pleasure or pain, that is already the beginning of a lot of trouble, right? And you see, we get conditioned to that. You see, now we'll come back to all that a bit later, but and are there any more points? I'll just have one more, and then perhaps we'll go on, try to go on.
Now, the endorphin feeling seems to be the best that we can do without transforming into another state of being. So we seem to prefer to be in that and spend our lives looking for ways suddenly or obviously to be in it.
Yeah, well, anything that would give endorphins would be the equivalent to taking morphine, or be even better, and would therefore you feel good for the time being, right? But you can't maintain the endorphins forever, and it's bound to change, you see. So I think there are other chemicals which can cause anxiety, for example, and there are still others that cause something else and something else, and you know, they all go onto the receptors in a way you can't control, right? So therefore that process is not going to really work. You'll find out, if you look at it, it's not coherent, right? The attempt to control the endorphins.
I think we find that out, I find that out, but then that other state beyond doesn't seem to arrive.
Yeah, well, suppose, yeah, but you see, the other state is projected by the system, you see. Suppose we begin by saying that if we start that way, we have already gone into the system. Because that pleasure which the other state projects is the same pleasure as the endorphins, right? You see, that therefore we have to say that the only right way to do it would be to say we want to see what is correct, what is true, you know, what is coherent, you know.
That's not the same as seeking pleasure.
Well, no, but I'm saying that even if you get pleasure from it, fine, except it may get distorted, you see. But I'm saying the key question is, are we going to, that if this process is not coherent, none of it has any meaning. Whether you have pleasure or pain or fear or whatever, right? Is that, if the, when the process has sustained incoherence, then it all has no meaning. You see, somebody could get great pleasure by deluding himself. The extreme case being, I'm God or I'm Napoleon. And if he deludes himself sufficiently, perhaps he could keep out all evidence to the contrary. And therefore he could get pleasure, but he would probably get bored with it after a while. You see, you can't maintain it forever. So I think that the attempt to live by pleasure is not, or endorphins, is not able to work. Now that's the first thing to notice. It's not coherent, then what do we do, you see? I think we have to understand this process better, that's what it means. That we are caught up in a process, in a system that isn't making sense.
Would you say that being aware, I don't know if this is the right word, but being aware of the system has already bypassed that chemistry? It's not getting hooked up into the chemistry of the endorphins?
Well, to some extent, but probably you would find it as you would get hooked up anyway later, because something will happen that sort of comes in with, too fast or too powerfully.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean forever.
Yeah.
I just meant at the moment as you are watching this process unfolding, so to speak, that the need to stay with the endorphins or the fear of the pain, all that may be, you may have sort of gone out the back door.
Well, you may have begun to move on another level, or let's put it that way. But
okay.
That's a possibility, you see. We should say maybe there's another level that's awakening, you know, which is not controlled that way by the system.
Yeah.
It seems we start this inquiry with the notion that I am inquiring and I being my endorphins and all of that. And that right there might be a tremendous assumption.
Well, we have to say we have all that, and I am all that stuff in the system, but at the same time, maybe I have potential for more, right? That's all you can say. So we're exploring, do we have the potential for more than that? Not assuming it.
Well, it's seemed to come to me, and maybe it's not useful at this point, is that the inquiring, what inquires, might have nothing to do with endorphins.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That may be the potential beyond the system. If it's true inquiry, then perhaps it's beyond the system. I mean, but don't assume it, because then it will be part of the system. And every assumption goes into the system.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I would like to make another step, you know, that there's another way we can look at this, and which is to look at thought, to say thought is a set of reflexes, which gives some insight, right? Now, what is a reflex? Reflex means to bend back. You see, turn back, the same as reflect. And you have a knee-jerk reflex. If you hit your bone here, the knee will jerk. See, what happens is the nerves carrying the signal up somewhere, they cross over perhaps in the spine and go out as an outgoing signal to make your knee jerk, right? Now, that one of the most elementary reflexes. Now, we have a lot of reflexes, and these can be conditioned. You see, for example, Pavlov had this, that a dog has a reflex seeing food, it salivates, right? The reflex always has that form. A certain thing happens, and as a result, something else happens, you know, just so automatically. Then he rang a bell many times, and after a while, the dog would salivate without seeing food, but just hearing the bell, right? So you can say perhaps the bell reminded him of the food, and then he salivated, or perhaps eventually it went through, it skipped that stage, and the bell just made it salivate. So that the reflex was conditioned, right, by the bell, right? In other words, it was subject to another condition. And that is the basic form of conditioning, to repeat something quite often, and it leaves somehow a mark in the system, in the nerves, and then a reflex has been altered. You can see conditioning of reflexes all the time. In fact, a great deal of our learning consists in establishing conditioned reflexes. I mean, for routine learning, say, for example, to learn to drive a car, you're trying to condition your reflexes so that they will be appropriate. When you learn to write, the same way, you don't want to have to think all the time of how you're going to write and walk or, you know, do various things. So certain reflexes are established and conditioned. Now, I'm going to say that a thought, we've already said that having a thought registers in memory. Now, I think it registers in the form of a reflex, you see. Memories often take that form, that namely you see something and it reminds you of something, right? That is a kind of reflex. Or it makes you do something, or it makes you see something in a certain way. You see, or somebody says something and you feel a certain feeling. See, the conditioned reflexes can affect the feelings. It could affect your adrenaline, saying a certain thing makes you frightened. It could affect your thought, saying this thought leads to that one and that leads to that. You get a chain of thought, right? So you could say thoughts, elementary thoughts, may take the form of a series of reflexes. And see, for example, if somebody asks you your name, you have an immediate answer. It's a reflex. Now, a more difficult question, see, there's a way the mind searches in the memory for an answer. There's a searching reflex that's set up, which then finds an answer which may sort of seem to fit or something, and then it comes out. And you can see whether it does fit or not. I'm proposing now that, therefore, this whole system works by a set of reflexes, and these reflexes are potential. Thought is a very subtle set of reflexes, potentially unlimited, right? We can add more and more, but you can modify your reflexes, you see. Suppose if you say, all people of this kind are So, you know, all, you might say, like the logicians say, all swans are white. But then you modify it by saying, oh, I've seen some swans may not be white, right? And so on, another one. And they, even the whole logical process, once it's committed to memory, becomes a set of reflexes, right? You think logically by a set of reflexes. So there may be a perception of reason beyond the reflexes, but anything perceived becomes sooner or later a set of reflexes, and that's what we call, I want to call thought, right? Which includes the emotion, the bodily state, and the physical reaction and everything else. So I say that there's, it's useful to look at this as a system of reflexes, because a reflex just works, right? You've seen it work with the knee-jerk. Now, we don't usually think that thought is like the knee-jerk reflex. We think that we are controlling thought and producing thought, right? See, that's part of our whole background. Is that clear? Now, I'm suggesting that is not generally so with me, you know, that a vast part of our thought just comes out like that, right? You only find out what it is after it comes out. Right? Now that really overturns a great deal of the way we look at the mind, right? And the personality. Our whole cultural background, most cultures. It's worth pondering that then, that thought, that this whole system works as a system of reflexes. And the question is, can you become aware of the reflex character of it? That it is a reflex.
I think it's fair to characterize it in that kind of singular reflex as distinct from an emerging constellation of reflexes.
Well, that's what I meant, a whole system of reflexes, which is constantly capable of being modified, added, changed. And we could say that as long as it's free to change, then intelligence, there must be some kind of intelligence which could be able to see whether it's coherent or not, right? Something a bit beyond the reflex. But then when it gets conditioned too strongly, then it may resist that perception, or may not allow it. See, so is that clear what I mean? That now, the thing is then that these reflexes serve us if they're not too rigid. Because then, if they don't work, if they're incoherent, we can drop them, or they may drop themselves. But on the other hand, when the reflex gets very strong and rigid, it won't be dropped. Now, I think there's a neurophysiological, chemical reason for that. See, every thought involves some change in the chemistry of the system, right? A strong thought with a lot of emotion and so on involves a bigger change. Or constant repetition builds up the change, or both together make a very powerful effect. And now, see, people have said that there are synapses, the nerves don't quite touch, there are synapses which connect them. And experience and perception and so on, and thought establishes synapse connections. And the more you repeat that pattern, you may assume or suppose that they're getting stronger, you see, more and more. And after a while they get very strong, right? Very hard to shake. So you could say that something happens in the chemistry and the physics or the neurophysiological process, so that this is not purely an intellectual problem or an emotional problem or even a physical problem. Cat surprise, huh?
All of a sudden, I was aware that it had a lot of potential.
Yeah, more than it wanted. So, the reflexes get conditioned very strongly, you see. And they're very hard to change, you see. And they interfere. Say, a reflex may connect to the endorphins and produce an impulse to hold that whole pattern further. In other words, produce a defensive reflex. Now, not merely is it stuck because it's chemically so well built up, but also there's a defensive reflex which defends this against evidence that might weaken it. See, so it all happens one reflex after another after another. It's just a vast structure, a system of reflexes. They form a structure as they get more rigid, right?
Is this the learning of evolution, though? Isn't this also how our bodies have evolved?
Well, it may be, but now the question is, are those reflexes coherent? Right? I mean, according to the theory of evolution, incoherent systems don't last very long, you see. It's called natural selection. Huh? But we seem to, in thought, we seem to be able to keep up at least quite a while with these incoherent systems of reflexes, you see. See, it's not that sometimes the people who have them won't live, and they may, but in our society, we have arranged conditions where we can go on with a lot of incoherence without actually leading to a selection process. Therefore, the point is now that reflexes can become incoherent and get stuck, right, by all these mechanisms.
If you had to use another word for incoherence, what would it be?
Inconsistent, conflicting. You see, these are all what is incoherent may show up as contradiction, as inconsistency, as conflict, right? As stress.
And
what?
Inappropriate.
Inappropriate, yes. But if it's sustained, what I mean is that there is sustained incoherence, right? That you. It just keeps on going in spite of the fact that there's evidence that would show it's incoherent, right? Now, we could say that intelligent response would be seeing incoherence to stop it, suspend it, and begin to look for the reason for the incoherence and change it. But I say there's a defense of incoherence. A typical case is that if it gets attached to the endorphins, an incoherent train of thought attached to the endorphins will defend itself, right? Because it will feel very uncomfortable when that's questioned. And you start to remove the endorphins.
Is there an analog between incoherence and cancer?
Well, cancer is an incoherent growth. It's incoherent with the whole system, the body, and it grows on its own, you see. For some reason, it's not accepting whatever system the body has to keep the thing in order. The cancer is not accepting it. It defends itself against it, and in fact, even mobilizes the body to support it. You see, I read somewhere that certain kinds of cancers can sort of send out chemicals to the body, which cause the body to grow blood vessels to feed the cancer. Which is a highly incoherent process from the point of view of the body.
In that view, any form of disease would be the same thing.
Yeah, a kind of incoherence, yeah. It would say it's incoherence with the whole organism or whatever.
Can we say that stress would be a crystallization of this system?
Well, stress would be a lot of conflict resulting from this incoherence, which begins to, you can see it affects the chemistry. Not only in the brain, but all over the body, and and producing further changes which keep on accumulating.
Can we use the word reaction with reflexes, or these reflexes only physiological, the reaction is psychological?
Well, but I think that it is, I want to emphasize that it's not just psychological. I think every reaction is also neurophysiological. That's why I prefer to call it a reflex. That no matter how, every reaction of thought is always simultaneously emotional, neurophysiological, and chemical, and everything else. That it's all one system, you see. In some cases, it may not be important, but there's always a slight effect at the very least. And when there's a powerful conditioning, then the effect is very great. I mean, when you just have a thought, this is on the table, it's a rather minor effect, but some physical effect is going on just to say that.
Could we say that anything we do or think that is out of harmony with the whole would be incoherent.
Yes, well, then it depends on what we mean by the whole, though, you see. Incoherence arises, they say the sign of incoherence, it's hard to give a positive definition, but the sign of incoherence, and the basic sign is you're getting something which you don't intend, right, and don't want. And the other signs are contradiction, conflict, stress, you know, all those things.
Confusion,
yeah.
And also action to force getting out of the confusion.
What?
And also would be the action and the force would apply to get out of the confusion.
Yeah, well, we may have an inappropriate action. I see within that system, the action to get out is part of the trouble, right?
When he said the whole, first of all, we couldn't know what the whole meant.
Yeah.
That it would almost seem like incoherence could only be take place in less than the whole.
Well, some part is not coherent with the rest.
We establish limits and we say, for example, our craziness as human beings might be part of the greater coherence of eliminating the species because it's so disruptive.
Yeah, if you take a great enough whole, then it's coherent. That is,
right.
I mean, the universe as a whole is coherent, and anything incoherent we do is just part of the coherence of the universe when you look at it that way, right? Because if we do something crazy, we will get a result we don't want. Huh?
So we might, at our level of coherence, attempt to come to, or at our level of incoherence, out of that we might try to become coherent, and that might be part of the incoherence.
Well, you see, you could say in the universe as a whole is... there's no reason to say there's incoherence, right? But if we, in our particular structure, are not coherent, let's take the case of a species that is not coherent either in itself or with its environment, it doesn't survive, right? That's part of the coherence of the universe. It's just because the universe is coherent that an incoherent species doesn't survive.
Right. It may also be part of our coherence that we're questioning our incoherence too, though, right?
I mean, yeah.
It could be the universal coherence that is stepping in and saying, wait a minute, this isn't working.
Yeah. It could be that that's part of it too. See, the question is, you know, then which is going to prevail, you see? This questioning or the old conditioning habits, right?
At the moment of conception, is each new human being pretty much predestined to have this incoherence, could we say?
Well, I think it's built into the nature of thought that this is a possibility, and by now we have built up a society and a culture which implants it in everybody, even if it were not there. But also, that possibility was there the minute you had creatures who could think as that much, right? That it wouldn't go coherently, you see, because thought is reflex, right? Now, I've outlined to you the possibility of conditioning the reflex by repetition and by powerful emotions in other ways, by defensive methods. And then it could get stuck, and then there would come a time when that reflex was no longer appropriate and it wouldn't be able to change, you see. Therefore, that would produce incoherence. If something changes and the reflex doesn't, you've got incoherence.
What was your called death in relation to life?
Well, you see, from the point of view of the species, that death is part of this whole process, you see, that, right? That you could say that species have evolved in such a way they last a certain time, you see. Perhaps, you know, that a certain kind of species would be better able to survive if the it didn't last too long. You know, other kinds could last longer.
It all ends in death.
Yeah. But still, well, you don't, it depends what you mean by all.
Eventually, in the terms of time.
Yeah, but you see, all, you see, the universe doesn't end in death. It may, this present universe may itself change, but perhaps there's something beyond that, right? So it's a question, any particular thing will end in death, right? I think it's changing. Ready? Yes, I mean, the question of death is a very long and subtle one. I might get to it later, but I mean, just for the moment, no matter what, if you look at any material structure, it's always changing, and it cannot last forever, right? We have a certain attitude to death, which we have to ask whether it's coherent or not. Right? You can't ask whether death is coherent.
it's a limited attitude.
Yeah, it's no point asking whether death is coherent or not. Death just is the fact, right? But our attitude may not be coherent. Maybe that's why it disturbs us so much.
What is the criteria for coherence?
Well, test for it. There's no unique criterion, but you have to be sensitive to incoherence. But the test for incoherence is you're getting results you don't want, you know.
Okay, so we have two things which are opposing each other.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And you can see that as contradiction and conflict as confusion. And coherence is sensed as harmony, order, beauty, you know, goodness, whatever.
Flow.
What?
A flow,
but it's sensed as what is good, right, true, harmonious, orderly, beautiful. All that everybody wants, right?
Is the incoherence in the DNA and we are born with that?
Well, not this particular incoherence in thought. The possibility that of our thinking is somehow in the DNA, and the possibility is implicit in there that that could go wrong, right? Given a set of circumstances which will condition it to go wrong. Now, somehow in the history of the human race, that has happened. We don't know whether it was inevitable, but it certainly, we can see that it looks likely, considering the nature of our brain, that this sort of thing could happen.
Well, that's why, for instance, Hitler is born. And probably that incoherence there.
Well, it's also the society. You see, you can't tell where the incoherence is in the system as a whole, which not only produced Hitler, you know, not only his genes, but also he grew up in the Austrian society at the time, which had some very nasty features and very incoherent features. You see, for example, Hitler was beaten mercilessly by his father, and he ran away when he was young, and he was beaten when he came back. Then again, it was thought, many people say that Hitler thought he had a Jewish grandfather or something, and this disturbed him because he hated the Jews so much. And all of this must have muddled him up very badly, you see. And so you can say there are all sorts of factors which added in. Maybe if they hadn't been there, he would have been different. Who knows, huh?
Yeah.
That particular genetic structure born into that particular crazy society produced Hitler's. So perhaps somewhere else it would have produced something else. Maybe he would have been a great genius in some other situation because he had some kind of ability anyway.
Did you say any form of violence that we perceive, any form of violence or disturbance would be incoherent then?
Violence is incoherence in a way, yes, because what we mean by violence, violence means the undue use of force, you see, in the dictionary. And that's a kind of incoherence. If you're using force where force is not called for, that's incoherent. See, for example, if the problem arises in thought and you use force, that is uncalled for. Therefore, the attempt by violence to deal with social problems is incoherent. Because they all arise in thought, and violence will never solve the problem in thought.
You think our cosmology is coherent?
Probably not. You see, no thought is fully coherent. The point is, we are going, the nature of thought is such that it's partial. I'm going to discuss that later, right? But it can, when we discover incoherence, our attitude can be to move toward coherence, or to defend the incoherence, right? Now, the kind of incoherence I'm talking about is the defense of the first kind of incoherence, right? Mm. So that if you find some incoherence, suppose you get used to a certain reassurances of security and they give you endorphins, and then if somebody, evidence comes up that you're not so secure, you may reject it. That's the kind of incoherence I'm talking about, that it won't look at the evidence, which is evidence of incoherence, right? Do you see what I mean? That there's a defense against evidence of incoherence, and that is the kind I'm talking about, because you will never get rid of all incoherence in thought, right? Do you see what I mean?
The defense against it is because it interrupts the cosmology or belief system that we've all been imprinted with.
Yeah, but that has been connected to the endorphins. No, but that alone wouldn't do it. It's much more complex. It has been connected to the endorphins, and when we question that, we start removing a lot of endorphins from all the brain cells, and suddenly the brain cells are jangling terribly, saying, quick, do something to stop this. And the thing to do is to reject that. Well, you can look at it, but I'm saying that it's part of it, but I'm saying it's not the whole of it.
Right.
You cannot separate one part of the system from the other. You see, if we had brains working properly, we could look at incoherence in cosmology and say, yes, how interesting, a good chance to find a new cosmology, right? But on the other hand, if we get a lot of comfort out of our cosmology, the brain cells will suddenly jangle and erupt. They won't give you a chance to look at it.
You said once that envy is an integral part of the human brain.
What?
Envy. How can we then discover this?
Did I say that?
I think you did in a five-page talk in Brock, but I don't know that. It was a long lecture about that. Since if this is an integral part of the brain, and we are stuck.
No, well, we can. the potential for producing envy is an integral part of the brain, right? But not, it is not necessary that it be actualized, you see, all the time, right? That if we can begin to see the process which is making envy, then the envy can come to an end.
You have to recognize first that you are envious.
Yeah, well, that's necessary, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and then to begin to look into, envy is the same sort of thing. It's a comparison with somebody and saying, he's got something that I need, right, or want. And then it makes you feel uncomfortable, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it removes, just for the sake of argument, it removes a lot of endorphins from a lot of cells, and then you get a very great discomfort. And say the way to get it back is to do better than that point. You see that you feel more comfortable.
I wonder then what about people who seem to glory and delight in misery? Is that producing some kind of endorphins also?
Well, they're probably getting some kind of pleasure out of it. You see, it's a very twisted kind of thought that gives pleasure from the misery. I mean, like, you know, there are all sorts of ways to do that, right? Saying, you know, that I'll show, you know.
Or it's avoiding worse outcomes.
Yeah, maybe avoiding something worse, yeah.
I think you're differentiating now between feeling bad and feeling good. You're saying they're not the same? That one's twisted and one is...
Well, no, but I'm saying that you can feel good for twisted reasons or feel bad, you see.
Is there a difference, though?
Well, if the reasons are twisted, there's no difference, right? But if you feel good genuinely, then it's the next thing. You know, you may feel bad because you're not well, you know, and so on, you see. I think that, see, the question of making good or bad feeling, the key to your thought process is part of the incoherence. The question is, what about the question of coherence and truth? Doesn't that take precedence?
Now, with this coherence, we're not saying coherence is good and incoherence is bad. We're just saying that is what they are according to their own things, and that's all.
Yeah, but we're saying there's a second order incoherence which avoids facing the first order, right? Well, which avoids facing evidence of incoherence. And we're saying, well, as a matter of fact, that will produce all sorts of consequences which we could say are destructive. Now, if you don't mind destructive consequences, okay, go ahead.
Right. The only reason I bring this up is we might get the notion in our thinking that incoherence is bad and it shouldn't be, whereas it's only saying that it's a conflict, one side opposing the other, and apparently it wants to resolve itself, but no good or bad. We're not in a position to say good or bad.
Well, morals have no place at this stage, you see. I mean, we're just trying to get a clear perception of it. And saying, but you will discover that, in fact, you don't want to be constantly getting results that you don't want. You see, at some stage, you will discover that incoherence is producing all sorts of things you don't want, and perhaps you would like to get rid of it, right? You see, or at least get rid of that second order kind.
A good clue to look at this incoherence that is covering up would be to see any form of violence, like any time a person is defending himself or wanting to change something because it's frustrating, or that would be a clue that it's an incoherence right there.
Yeah, that's right. There are all sorts of clues. You have to become sensitive to those clues. And the thing to notice is that your incoherent actions are reflexes. You are not doing them on purpose. You don't know that you are doing them. The same, your knee jerks whether you like it or not, right? When you hit it. So similarly, when something touches that conditioning, those reflex conditioning, it just jerks. It produces the result which you don't want. So consciously, you're trying to get A, but the reflex just jerks and gives you B, right? And you say, I don't want B, but you don't know where it's coming from, so you fight B while you keep on with the reflex that produces it. You see, that's where the problem is.
Are we talking about the possibility of an interval? In the interval, for example, if the physician is about to hit my knee, I could stop him. I don't know if there's any value in what I'm about to say. And as you say hypothetically attacked me negatively, I could hold it in abeyance. Is that a valid?
Well, you could try that. You see, I'm suggesting that we're engaging in learning about this. We don't know yet what to do with it. You see. We have to be interested in learning for its own sake, you see, because if we have any other sake, it's going to enter the conditioning, right, you see? You see, you will find, nevertheless, that you do want to learn for the sake of making things better, but then you have to say, well, that is also part of another reflex, do you see? See how one reflex springs up after another, right? You see, I've understood now, and I've learned that to learn in order to do things in order to make things better may be a trap, right, in this area. I've learned that, but then I still do it, right? Because the reflexes still work, right? So then I have to say, I've got to learn about those reflexes that are diverting me. The point is that what's characteristic of this is as you understand this, it doesn't work, right? This is not right away anyway. That you seem to understand the point, and it doesn't work. Now, but if you'll see what I said, you will see that it's inevitable that it won't work, because we first understand it on a certain abstract level. We haven't touched those reflexes, right? Therefore, you could say, I understand that my knee jerks whenever you touch it, but of course it doesn't change, right? You see, how are we going to change the reflexes? You see, that's the question. See, that the understanding is important, you see, but it will not be enough. You see, now, anybody who has been in this game for a while will notice that all these things which are understood don't work, right?
Well, maybe they work in the first stage, because we start by the understanding, and then after this rational understanding, maybe something deeper happens.
It may, but very generally people find that it doesn't work. You see, that we have to go deep. There's something more is needed, I'm saying. That we have somehow, and somebody may get an understanding so deep that it does touch the reflexes. We'll come to that possibility later, right? Then it will change. But usually the understanding is a verbal or intellectual understanding or image. It doesn't mean that it has no value, but it means it's still too abstract.
They need some homework and they understand it to go deeper.
That's it, yes. Some homework which will make it touch the reflexes. You see, in school we are unfortunately often taught that when you have understood this thing abstractly, then you've understood it. But you all know even there when it's sort of kind of, I mean, it kind of comes to put it in practice, you can't. So the thing is that we have to notice, then we try this and it doesn't work. Then the first response may be, well, it doesn't work, I give up. But you see, in anything where you're serious, you don't do that, right? If you're serious about it, you say, well, okay, it didn't work, why not, you see?
Well, just even using the analogy of the knee-jerk, I heard a doctor refer to someone where the knee-jerk reaction was a slow term, and it's a medical term, I don't remember it, but not all knee-jerks are as fast, so the speed would be involved.
Well, some are faster, some are slower, you see, but any reaction which has, in the thought, which has very powerful emotions or has been repeated a great many times will probably work very fast, you see.
I wonder if part of our difficulty is that we're imbued with a notion that we can understand, where the understandings that's being referred to might have nothing to do with anything I know about. See, I might be going after this understanding and think that it's something I can grasp, whereas actual understanding might be something operating in an entirely different level, and one would never say that one understood.
Yeah, well, there's some confusion about understanding, let's put it that way, and we have to get into that further. You see, what does it mean? And but I think that the fact is that, see, people make see things that they're doing wrong, and but then when they're not paying attention, they find themselves doing it anyway, you see. And I think the reason for that is simple, that you're dealing with the system consists of a set of reflexes. That's exactly what reflexes do. You see, for example, if you brush your teeth in the morning, you follow a routine, and you may very often start doing things of a similar nature when the occasion, when it's not the right occasion and you find it isn't working. You see what I mean? If you get up and start the reflex and the thing that belongs there is not there, right? Then you say, here's an incoherence, and then you stop, right? You see, so all those reflexes are... See, I think we have to pay attention that if we think of these as reflexes, we are going to understand this thing and another. It will help us to understand it better and also begins to point to another level. The reflexes are on the level of the neurophysiology and the chemistry. The thought process is also chemistry, but it's a very much more subtle, abstract level. And it doesn't directly touch the reflexes. The intellectual part of the thought process does not directly touch the reflexes, right?
You can't think your knee not jerking.
Yeah.
Now, we are still on the surface in the intellectual, but that homework, that means attention is needed. Then the attention is really a potential to take us deeper.
Yes, we have to get a kind of attention that will take us deeper, but see, I think that what we do need, however, is to draw this intellectual map. You see, the intellect has to be clear, because we already, in any case, have a large number of intellectual maps that are not clear about this thought process. The whole culture has given us a lot of maps. For example, it said that thought and feeling and so on, and the chemistry are all different, right? Well, that's a map which is wrong, misleading. So there are a lot of maps of that kind that are wrong. Now, what we have to do is to see, get somewhat free of them and to give it more coherent map. But that alone, I'm trying to just add that alone is not going to do it. Yes, we should be stopping soon, yes. Right.
Isn't part of the problem the fact that the initial reflex doesn't work?
Which reflex?
It's the carrying on of the reflex.
Yes, but that's the whole nature of reflexes, to carry on, you see.
It is conditioned for some reason.
Yeah, but that's the nature of reflexes, to get conditioned when you repeat them. That will be inevitably produce carry-on effects.
But supposing you intellectually understood this process, but still that initial reflex was so enticing that you still...
Yes, that's the problem, saying that you can intellectually understand it, but it still carries on. The enticement is part of the reflex. It's the chemical part of the reflex. I mean, the reflex produces endorphins, for example, which will be very, or some other chemical, which will produce a sense of enticement.
So it's a matter of perspective, then, to see deeper than
beyond. Well, I think it's a bit more than that. You see, let's try to go into that as we go along. I think we need to have a break now. We'll try to make it 10 minutes. Say a few more... extend this whole idea a little further. I'm saying that it's important to have a... We inevitably have a kind of thought about thought, an intellectual map of the thought process, which is sort of endemic. It's all spread in our culture, right? We pick it up here and there. Like saying think positively, you see, for example, that's... A kind of intellectual idea about thought as to how to deal with depression, right? And so on. And there are all sorts of ideas circulating around. So I think I'm trying to present some sort of map of thought which will make me more coherent. Because if we are being guided by incoherent ideas, which are already part of our reflex system, therefore we will go wrong, you see. And we can't just choose not to do it because it's part of the reflex system, you see. So the first step is at least to look at some other ideas which may be more coherent, and we'll have to ask how we're going to really have them really work on the reflexes, which will come later. Now, because eventually we must begin to, there must be some way to alter those, affect those reflexes, right? Otherwise we're stuck. Now, I wanted to add that one of the basic, if we combine this notion of reflex, one of the thoughts which has one of the most powerful effect is the thought of necessity. You see, it is much more than a thought. The word necessary means it cannot be otherwise, but it also, the Latin root necessi means don't yield. It suggests the emotional, physical stance of resisting, holding, right? And I mean, that's the other side of the system. That when you say it can't be otherwise, you see the other, then you say, it's got to be this way, so I've got a hold. It also means it cannot be turned aside. You see, some very powerful force you can't turn aside, then you say, I've got to turn aside. You see, we establish an order of necessity, saying this turns aside for that and this for that, right? We're saying, so this is crucial to our whole ordering of thought, see, the notion of necessity. And its opposite, which is contingency, which means what can be otherwise, right? Now, if something can be otherwise, it's worth trying to change it. If it can't be otherwise, then no use trying to change it, right? So this will have a tremendous effect. If you think something is impossible, it means that it can't be done. It's the same. It's necessarily, that's necessary, and therefore you can't do it and you will not try, you see. So the assumption that something is impossible may well trap you into making it impossible, right? On the other hand, you may assume something is possible which is not, and just batter your head on a stone wall, you see, and also suffer, you see. So we have to get straight on what is necessity and what is contingency. And in each situation, this is what you're doing all the time. We're trying to assess the necessity and contingency. Like, we say that this will not turn aside for my hand, right? I don't expect it to. I don't expect my hand to go through, right? If it went through, I'd be very surprised. You know, we discussed this last time, that Joe was telling about, there was an exhibition of lasers, very good lasers, with an image of a ship, very realistic, and two people came in who evidently didn't know anything about it. And one woman came over and decided to take hold of the ship, and her hand went through. So she didn't understand it. There was a look of horror in her face, and she said to her companion, "Let's get out of here." See, this the point is that we count on the notion of necessity, saying this will stand up, this will be stable, this will cannot be turned aside, and so on. We count on the earth being something that won't turn aside, and when it shakes, it's very disturbing, psychologically as well as physically. And the point is that this notion of necessity and contingency is it's always operating. Everybody's using it all the time, you know, without it becomes part of our reflexes. And this is important, you see, that once something is necessary, if we think it's necessary, this also is connected with the idea of reality, because things which are real sort of won't be turned aside. They'll sort of resist, they'll pushing and so on, various ways of testing for reality. Right? They're stable, they resist, they have a kind of internal necessity that holds, you see. And the whole idea of reality and necessity are bound together, you see. Because if your hand goes through this, it's a sign it's not real, right? The notion of reality is very important too, clearly, in our whole psychic makeup. The difference between being real or unreal or illusory is very crucial. And the notion of necessity creates a very powerful reflex, right? It's got to be that way, right? See, if we not only add emotion to the reflex, we not only add repetition to the reflex, but if we add the notion of necessity, it becomes very powerful. Especially, we can say, if we say it's always necessary, you see, something may be necessary some of the time, but then it may give way, it may have to turn aside at another time. But if we say it's always necessary, it means it's absolutely necessary, and it cannot turn aside, right? For example, if we say the nation is sovereign, that becomes absolute necessity, and there's no way of turning that aside. Now, if two nations assert their sovereignty in the same place, what can they do? You see, there's no way to turn aside, right? And therefore, they've got to fight. Now, or two religions in the same way. You see, God is absolute necessity, and God has got to be this way and not that way, and there's no way to turn aside, right? There are similar questions all through life, that wherever people are finding it hard to get along, you will discover they have different assumptions as to what is necessary or absolutely necessary, right? If you look at it, that's what they're fighting about. One feels this is necessary and the other that, and they cannot turn aside. And negotiation is an attempt to make people turn aside for each other and to adjust and adapt, right? Which admits some of the contingency of what they thought was necessary. So, therefore, this question of dialogue, which we're going to get into, is involved very much in what you assume to be necessary. The assumptions of what is necessary are what prevent dialogue. And they create a set of reflexes to defend and with absolute force. They give power to the reflex. You see, the instinct of self-preservation is generally regarded as a very powerful set of reflexes, but built in from the genes. Right? But the notion of absolute necessity will override that every time. You see, if you say my instinct is to preserve my life, but if you say the country says it's absolutely necessary to risk it, then you've got to risk it. See, most people will feel that way. Or if you say, my God demands it, then the demands of God will override all the instincts. Right? So the or else, whatever it is, your ambition may override instincts, right? If it's absolutely necessary to achieve your ambition. So, therefore, there's a tremendous force in this notion of necessity. Is not merely intellectual; it involves everything, right? It involves the chemistry, and it means that all the adrenaline you need will be released when to defend it, right? Whatever is needed will be made available, right? So And this may have very valuable side. If you're ever going to accomplish anything, you need that, right? You see, if you don't think something is very necessary, you won't have much energy to do it. You could say nobody ever accomplished anything difficult without really going through difficulties, without feeling that it was necessary. And therefore, if you feel that going into thought is necessary, perhaps it will continue against difficulty. On the other hand, you may feel that some crazy incoherent thing is absolutely necessary and do the same. You see, it's important, however, to begin to pay attention to these notions of necessity, what is assumed to be necessary and absolutely so, and how it moves you. You see, to begin to notice that. You get that feeling of urge. You see, you're impelled. You have an impulse to act, right? Impelled means being pushed, right, from within. You're being compelled, which is a bit stronger sometimes, compulsive urge, or propelled, or perhaps even repelled. But it's all the same process, right? It's necessity at work, giving a push. You feel an impulse and you say, well, that's me having an impulse, but you can see there's a system, there's a thought beneath it. Your intentions may arise in that impulse. I think people have shown that sometimes when you have an intention, they've made electrical scans of electrical measurements and seen there's some electrical process in the brain that precedes your conscious intention. It's built up. So electrochemical process. So it's coming from the whole thing, the whole system, you see. Now you see, it's important to see this all connected, because when you break it up, this is not a place where it's correct to break things, to separate them, you see. In some cases it's correct to separate them, like saying this table is separate from the chair, right? Because one can move independently of the other. But when things are tightly connected, then we shouldn't separate them in our minds. And the idea is that we may distinguish certain things, you know, for the sake of convenience. The word distinguish means to mark apart. A distinction is merely a mark, which is for convenience. It doesn't mean the thing is broken. It's like a dotted line. Whereas if we represent a divide, it's a solid line. So between thinking and feeling and chemistry and so on, we should draw dotted lines in our minds, not solid lines. It would be good to draw only dotted lines between countries, too. Because really, it's a distinction and not really a division of two different things which are independent. We have to then be able to think of this clearly, even though, as I said, that won't really change the reflexes. But if we don't think of it clearly, then I think all our attempts to get into this will go wrong. And clear thinking implies that we are in some way awakened a little bit, so perhaps there's something beyond the reflex which is at work, right? In other words, something unconditioned. Right? Is there the unconditioned? Is the question, really. If everything is conditioned, then there's no way out. But what suggests itself the very fact that we're able to see new things sometimes would suggest that there is the unconditioned there. Maybe the deeper material structure of the brain is unconditioned, or maybe beyond, who knows? We'll discuss that later. But it doesn't matter at this stage where it is, as long as it could act, you see. So if there is the unconditioned, which could be the movement of intelligence, then there is some possibility of getting into this. Now, so they're saying that perhaps unbeknownst to us, the unconditioned may have operated a little. You see, we're not trying to say that the conditioning is absolutely solid and frozen all forever. So that's the point. So at least to be coherent, we have, if we're going to do this sort of thing at all, we're doing, we have to suppose that there may be the unconditioned, you see. If we don't suppose that it may be, then we are totally incoherent in our very attempt to do it, right? Is that clear? If we say there may not be the unconditioned, it cannot be, then it would be foolish for us to try to do anything with the conditioning.
And of course, when we made that statement, we would have assumed a tremendous position of knowing.
Yeah. But if we once assume it, then we're stuck, you see. Now, if we assume that there is the unconditioned, then we're going to be stuck again, right? Because we will produce a sort of an image of the unconditioned in the system of conditioning. And mistake it for that, right? So suppose we say there may be the unconditioned. Now, we leave room for that, right? See, we have to leave room in our thought for possibilities.
Wouldn't we have to even say more in the sense that thought could never say there is not, there is only the conditioned? I mean, that we've gone way past our bounds when we make that statement.
Yeah, it's incoherent for thought to make that statement. Well, it will come to that thought doesn't know that much, you see. That it's clearly evident that it doesn't know that much, but, you know, we can even go into it more later. So, see, if thought merely sticks to what it knows, it has no way of saying there is no unconditioned, or nor can it safely say there is the unconditioned. So that means what? That we don't know. But we may say we suspect there is the unconditioned. We see evidence that there may be.
Is the evidence of the unconditioned sometimes seen in creativity?
Yes, that's what we want, some evidence. We could say the fact of creativity suggests that there is the unconditioned without proving it. Because some of the people in artificial intelligence would say that was merely a much deeper form of conditioning that you didn't see, right?
But even that would be better than the conditioning we have now.
Yeah.
Why? Well, you might, you know, get along with a few years with that one, whereas with this one we might.
We just expand our limitations.
Well, we might still get into incoherence, you see. See, but incoherence with creativity has become more dangerous than without it. You see, without having created all these modern scientific things, it would be much safer. We could go on with our incoherence at the Stone Age level. We would be quite safe with our incoherence. You know, we wouldn't have the means of doing very much, so we could probably survive indefinitely. And in fact, the evidence is the Stone Age people may well be more coherent than we are anyway, so that their attitude to nature is more coherent and so on. So, but even if they were as incoherent as we are, they could probably survive because they cannot do that much damage, right? Now, but then with our creative technology, we are put in... that challenges us, you see. Either we've got to be coherent, or else at least we've got to move toward coherence, or else all sorts of disasters may occur.
Can I look at my conditioning, even intellectually, and say, hey, I don't feel good when somebody yells at me, and take the responsibility, even intellectually, to look at it? And without having expectations of the end result, what it would be like if I don't have this conditioning. And just let it be. My main would be that I don't feel good when somebody yells at me, let me take the responsibility, why do I feel this way? And then just let it go.
Yeah, well,
whatever comes.
Yeah, but what happens then? You see, suppose you say, I don't feel good when somebody yells at me. Right? Then... you ask why not, right?
Why don't I feel good?
Yeah. And so what's the answer?
I have to look within me to see if there's any connection of memory, brain, cell, groups, whatever, that it's not really that particular person that's yelling, but any person that's yelling.
Yeah.
So it goes back to me again, because I'm dealing with different people and I'm the main...
Yeah, well, you have a general assumption there, don't you, that Emily, you are the sort of person who should not be yelled at, right? That it's absolutely necessary that nobody should yell at you. I mean, that seems to be the assumption, right? See, I think it's worth fishing around to try to put the assumption in words, right? Because it's important to get it into words, because you miss it otherwise. You see, the whole brain is set up to hide the assumption anyway.
Well, what is my understanding? My understanding would be that they have a right to yell.
But not at you.
No, it doesn't matter. It's why am I reacting to the...
Yeah, no, but, I mean, but before that, no, let's say before you got that far, right? The first thing you found was that you were disturbed by somebody yelling at you.
Right.
And I say, why?
Because it didn't make me feel good.
Yes, but why is that? Because the feelings come from, are bound up with the thoughts. We just said it's all one system, right?
Right.
So maybe there's a thought that's behind it.
The thought is that I'm not a good girl.
But why is that? You see, if somebody yells, it doesn't prove you're not good.
I'm believing that because of my conditioning thoughts.
Well, wait, let's go back then, you see. I'm saying that then you have another thought further back, right? Which you got maybe from your parents, right? Saying that whenever they thought you were no good, they yelled at you. So therefore you have an assumption in there that whenever anybody yells at me, it means I'm no good.
Right.
And therefore, whenever I'm no good, I feel uncomfortable, another one, right? That's another reflex. So those two work together as a reflex, is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever anybody yells at me, it means I'm no good, and whenever I'm no good, it means I can't feel good, right?
Right.
Now, those two thoughts are working in the chemistry.
Right. And I don't like it for what it does to me.
Well, I don't like that chemical effect. It's very disturbing, right? That makes sense, right? That chemical effect is disturbing. I mean, we can't criticize that.
I look, the person that felt that, the little person that was defenselessly or without defense or their perception that somebody yelled at them, they decided that I'm not going to go. Now I'm an adult and I have some responsibility to look at that and see that am I going to hold on to that perception or am I willing, able to let go.
What's the answer?
No. And this is to look at it, and I'm asking, the way the programming was done through the years of me having that perception, can that jump the groove, the needle jump the groove, and where there's a space, and that programming is canceled?
Well, that's what we're exploring, you see, that can it be done? But you see, what's implied is that there's got to be an electrochemical change in the brain.
Right.
You see, it's not enough. We have a certain set of thoughts which have begun to point to the problem. And now something that we've had that same problem as before, that alone is not enough to change the reflex.
Not the intellectual part, but the chemical part that... I know, I'm realizing now that I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, but it doesn't change. If somebody yelled at you, you might still feel uncomfortable.
No, but my experience has been that by realizing it, I'm letting the yelling come through and I'm feeling it in my body. I'm not resisting it.
Yeah, okay, then.
And by not resisting it, it desensitizes the old misfiring of the synapses or whatever. And it sort of reverses the process of what originally brought it to.
It may, you see. Yeah, that's what you can explore. You see that if you can stay with that, it may well do something like that. Right?
And if that happens and I see myself that, now I don't get upset with people yelling at me, I understand not intellectually, physically, the change has taken place. Now, do I move to another conditioning?
Well, you may. You see, it's a question. You see, that there are a vast number of reflexes, and we've only looked at that one, right? You see, we have to sort of get further, because one reflex gives rise to another and another. In the back, there's all sorts of reflexes ready to operate, some different ones, right? Hmm? And some of those may even bring back this original reflex. Hmm? You see, that you may have further assumptions which say that whenever I am too disturbed, I can do nothing about it. You see, that's a common assumption, right? Hmm? That I've just got to let it take hold of me. Hmm? Some people have that assumption, right? That if the disturbance is extremely powerful, then I've got to let it take hold, right? See, that's necessity, right? So that assumption could also come in later when, say, suppose you say, okay, somebody yelled at me, and in certain cases, I can already begin to see the chemistry and all that, and I don't respond so much. Then suddenly somebody who is very important to me really yells, and it happens again with beyond a certain intensity, and it sort of takes over again, right? Hmm? You see, that may happen. I don't say it will.
But hasn't she, when she has had that experience of the yelling not activating the chemistry, and together with that, if she has a proper description of what is taking place, hasn't she been pointed in a new direction, though someone else yelling may cause her? But she has been shifted.
Yes, there's a shift in direction, yes. You see, it's a step in the direction, but still there may be more, you see. Hmm?
The person who has had that experience is never the same, though. Even though they still react, they have a new opening, wouldn't you say?
Yes, but that opening can be lost if you don't keep it up, right?
Oh, yeah.
You see, it requires sustained work.
The rigidity of the assumption of the conditioning may be loosening a little bit, and the person can feel more comfortable, but I don't think that means that much is happening.
Well, there's a certain move has happened, but we have to go very much further, is what I meant to say.
Sometimes you can help you fool ourselves and say, oh, that's a transformation.
Oh, no, it's not a transformation.
Yes,
but
we have at the moment in this environment specifically the tendency very quickly to get in another assumption. I change, there's something happened in me, and I'm transformed.
No, well, that would be an unjustified conclusion. You see, without any evidence backing it up. I mean, that's a kind of thought that goes wrong, that we jump to a conclusion which gives pleasure or something. But I would say, just look at it as saying it's a step from which you can learn something.
Hmm? Provided the correct description
accompanies it. Yeah. Yeah, but you have to put it correctly in words, because the trouble is in the verbal sphere anyway, that which has gone into all the chemistry and all that. And in addition, all the other stuff is being carefully hidden by the reflexes, so that if you don't get into words, it's not likely you're going to see it, because, you see, the problem is not just the feelings or the reflexes and so on, it's the relation between all that and the words. You see, namely, the words were, the thoughts which are underlying the words, which you put in words, were that whenever anybody yells at me, it means I'm bad. Now, that is an assumption of necessity, right? Always. It's something always so. You see, that's why it's so powerful. Do you see what I mean? That you often don't see the power of the assumption of necessity. That, see, if you don't put it in words, this merely happens. But if you put it in words, you can see clearly, whenever anybody yells at me, it means I'm bad. You have to put it in words and say, that's the way I think. Right? Not to say, I'm just thinking about it. Do you understand? And then you will get a feeling of that, right? And I say, that's the way I really think. Now, but notice, that is an assumption of necessity, that whenever anybody yells at me, it's absolutely necessary to feel that I'm bad.
Hmm? It seems like you can reflect on it in this way, and then you're changing the focus from, you know, they shouldn't yell at me, to what's going on in the mind that's making it so terrible, or, you know, that's creating the reaction by looking at your hidden assumptions. But I'm just wondering, is there some key to get behind the whole system of reflexes rather than just like examining each one and saying, you know, what's the assumption behind that?
Well, you know, we have to explore that. You see, from what you learn, we examine it not in the spirit of trying to get rid of this reflex in particular, but rather in the spirit of learning more about the whole system. Right. So that maybe we learn something which can then be extended.
See, it seemed to me that the description that needed to accompany that was not simply the specific that I don't want people to yell at me and that bothers me, but rather that up to that point, I believed that someone out there saying something to me caused a disturbance in me. And now I see that in response to words, I generated disturbance in me.
Yeah, I didn't even do it. I have a set of reflexes that did it,
Yes. Which
came because I had concluded from a number of cases that it was absolutely necessary to feel bad whenever somebody yelled, right? And that it was the right thing to do and so on, you know, and that it was inevitable. You see, that was the thought. So that whenever somebody yelled, the reflex just worked. You see, just like the knee jerk.
Never mind what you say, how you say it is important, isn't it?
But I mean, the yelling conveys a message, right?
But haven't I, in seeing that, in some sense, I've shifted from thinking that the problem was external to...
Well, you've begun to look at the real source of the problem, which is your own reflex, you see. Saying that I also had another reflex before, is what you're pointing out, that whenever this happened, I added another reflex saying that this all has originated outside. You're saying that that's where the blame lies, right? The cause, huh? So, therefore, you see how when the reflexes all work together. In order to prevent you from seeing the real cause of the thing, the reflex system has developed an explanation of why you feel bad, which is that somebody outside has done something to you, right? That's a rationalization.
Mm-hmm. Right? Seems to indicate that the problem was always within this thought, not outside. So it's just a projection. Yes.
If your reflexes hadn't worked, nothing would have happened. You see, if somebody had, well, yelling works in every language, but you see, if somebody says something bad to you in a language you don't understand, nothing happens, right?
The tone of the voice sometimes may convey.
Well, yes, I say yelling will work in any language, even no matter what you say, but somebody can say something to you very quietly, which also means the same thing, right? And you will feel bad. But if you don't understand what he says, nothing happens.
It's kind of that little story of the boat that's coming to crash the other boat. The guy in this boat is yelling to the other boat. Then they crash, and he realizes nobody in the other boat, and he laughs.
What's that?
There was nobody to get angry.
Oh. Well, anyway, so the point is then that you have to watch. You see, it's crucial. Say, I have a valid reason which makes it necessary for me to feel bad or to get angry or to be frightened or various other things, right? Or to be, pleased or whatever, right? You see, these things will affect the chemistry. And the notion of necessity puts all the power behind it. You see, now you don't notice how often it's there implicitly rather than explicitly. So it's very important to get it there explicitly so that you really see it's there, right? Because the whole system is set up to prevent you from seeing this. You see, let's try to put it like this. Freud used to talk about repression of unpleasant memories and traumatic memories, right? And you say, how could this be? You would ask, it's a puzzling question. You must remember something to be able to repress it, you see, it seems to be a paradox. But it's not a paradox because, you see, our memory always has a vast content. A lot of it comes up which is irrelevant. And we have a lot of reflexes set up to sort of try to select what's relevant. even a normal memory, healthy. Now, that same reflex can be set up to repress this, to push down this unpleasant material. It simply responds to that material automatically like the knee jerk and gets it down, you see. You see that you don't need to do anything in particular. So the whole system is set up to do that sort of thing, right? So that it's really very hard to just look in there and see anything. But you see, if you get a hint or a clue, and then you can put it in words, and then you can begin to see at least what the thought is, and then you watch what the words do to your chemistry.
Something happens to thought when you express it. It makes it solid, it makes it real, you relate to it. Where in my mind, the thought can take over and I lose me.
Yeah,
but if I bring it out, it becomes more real, then I can look at it.
Yeah, it's implicit when you don't put it in words, and it can do all sorts of things. But now make it explicit, and then you can at least see the thought is doing it. So you're getting some perception, right? You see, by bringing it out, you can see that this is what's happening. Whereas if you don't make it explicit, you can't see that thought is involved at all. And therefore, you say this is an emotional problem, or some other problem, or somebody out there has done it. You know, various explanations.
Isn't it just as important, though, to, as you're putting into words, be aware or connected to the response in the body directly?
That's what I mean. To watch not only the words, but how they are. You see, when you say the words that are really the true words, expressing the way you really think, your body is going to respond. You see, if you say this, I've been hurt by that person, I'm very angry, you know, right? And then if you find out in words, I'm angry because he did this and this and this, and anybody who does this and this and this to me, it's absolutely necessary for me. It's only right and necessary for me to get angry or hurt or whatever, right? And watch, you will see that if you have found the right words, the body responds. That will be a nice demonstration of how the system works.
What sort of word you mean? You mean a word like I've been hurt, or
the words which express the real thought behind your hurt. You see, suppose you say, I don't know, I trusted that person. He was my friend, and I counted on him. And then he said those terrible things about me. It's a completely unjustified. I mean, it's traitorous behavior. You know,
I said I was stupid or something, and that started the process.
Yeah, that's right. And this was really something which was not justified, not right. You know, worse, you know, he betrayed me. He attacked me, you know. He had no reason to do this, you know. You think of all those words, and you will see the effect on the body. If you have found the right words, the body will be affected. If you have found the words which express the way you're really thinking.
So at first we have an intellectual anger, and then as we express it, the body picks up, and then we find out we're emotionally angry. The next thing you know, our voice is getting louder.
And then you find you're physically angry, namely you tense all over the body.
And
if you stay with it, you will finally get the impression this is nothing but a physical process. That's crucial, because you'll see this means, this is something which I'm anticipating for the next time, that thought is part of the physical processes of the body, a very subtle part.
It seems to me like I can reflect on, you know, some disturbing emotion that I've had and discover this underlying assumption of necessity. But then often, even though I can say rationally, well, it isn't really necessary, there's still a strong feeling. But it is necessary. You don't want to let go of it.
That's the reflex. You see, it's in the chemistry. You see, it's not only in the intellect, right? Now, what I'm suggesting, it won't cure it. It's a matter, this is being done to learn and not to change anything, right? This is crucial, because if you're trying to change anything, it won't work.
So you
find the words which do this and see how those feelings are affected and how the body is affected. You see, just simply to learn. Is that clear? it may make it go away, okay, fine, but it's not the purpose to make it go away.
We're just trying to get some perception into
that. Yeah. See, in fact, if it goes away too easily, it's wrong, because you won't have a chance to learn how it works.
But the purpose is learning.
Yeah.
And not changing.
Not changing, you see. And something may change it when you learn, but that's a byproduct. Hmm?
But can our conditioning prevent us from learning, because our preconditioning is, don't be angry, it's not nice. Don't cry, it's not acceptable. And when we started filling up with this emotion, our conditioning says, hey, stop. Well, you're not supposed to feel that.
Yeah, but that's the same thing. The conditioning is what we've been talking about. The conditioning is what makes us angry, and the conditioning tries to say, you know, you shouldn't be angry. It's all the same, you see. In other words, you may find that you've got to put that in words, saying, I believe it's absolutely necessary for me not to be angry, and begin to look at that, you see. There are also more words, you see. So the point is that this is a system, and it sort of spreads out and out and out. And therefore you don't expect to get it all right away by this process, by this procedure.
Well, we don't really ever expect to get anything, in the sense that any trying to move in there and take hold of anything has to be part of the system moving.
Yeah.
And you're suggesting something which lies outside of the
system. I'm saying we don't care, don't try to do anything, but you're just learning. And we're attentive learning, right?
That implies that while we are in the system, we're in a sort of trance, like a hypnotic trance.
And the system is, that's exactly what hypnosis is, you see, if you think it over. The hypnosis is the use of the word to operate the system, right? You see, the word, you accept the word of the hypnotist as to what is necessary, and that's all there is to it.
I have one question to go into a little bit. Are we out of time?
And just one more question.
Yeah.
Okay. It seems as if when we are aware of the system as a whole, a physiological process, the psychological process, the whole thing, as we touch on that, the description seems to be accurate. It comes out of that awareness. But when the intellect says, I need to find the right word to describe process, my experience has been that it doesn't work as well.
Well, I'm not suggesting you do that at this stage. I'm saying find the word that makes the process go with full strength. You see, it's like saying, I've got a piece of machinery, I want to make it go slowly so I can look at it. Not to spin with tremendous speed and I can't see it, or not to just stand still and I don't see how it works, right? Hmm.
Know where the button is?
Well, the button is the word.
Right. To understand the buttons.
Yeah.
So is it having just a very accurate description? Is that what you're saying?
No. A true description of the way you are thinking. You see, usually we don't put in words the way we really think, right? We won't admit to ourselves the real nature of our thoughts. You see, if you are hurt, you usually say, he hurt me, right? Mm-hmm. Hmm? Or I'm hurt, or I'm not hurt, right? You know, you'll say all sorts of things, right? Hmm?
Right.
Therefore, those words will just lead the whole thing astray, right? Hmm? Because they will not be correctly the thoughts which are really working. Hmm? They will just muddle it up. Hmm? So, suppose we say, I don't know exactly the words, but I'm going to experiment, try to find them. The words which express the thoughts that are really working, which are now implicit only. Hmm? I want to make them explicit. Hmm? So, I say, it may be, when I use those words, I feel worse. Now, therefore, my instinct is not to use them. Right? But I say, no, this is necessary, really necessary, truly necessary to get into this, right?
To dig until we find the words.
Yes, yes, you see. So I say, it's truly necessary. I've seen why it's necessary. Hmm? Hmm? So I say, that the fact that it hurts a little bit doesn't matter. Hmm? Even if you had a toothache, you see, you would go to the dentist and it would hurt a bit, but you say it's necessary for him to drill a bit, right? otherwise your tooth will decay. So, therefore, you say, okay, I'm going to dig a bit, it may hurt a bit, but it doesn't matter, right? I want to find out what's going on. Hmm? So I'll find... Hmm?
Can you just give an example of what you mean by... finding the words?
Well, I try to give some. Suppose you're angry and say, I'm angry, he kept me waiting 2 hours. You know, what did he mean by keeping me waiting so long? He takes me for granted. He doesn't consider my value at all. No, he does whatever. He probably had something better to do and he ignored me. You know, he kept me waiting here and my time is valuable. He just doesn't consider me properly. You know, there are all sorts of, you may find other reasons. You see, I mean, depending on what it is, you find the reasons, the words which express the real reason, right? Which seems to make it necessary to be angry. Hmm? Not to justify it, make it right and necessary. Hmm? Saying it's really, anybody would be angry in this case. You know, anybody treated this way would be angry. So it's absolutely necessary and universal. I'm really right. And so on and so on, right? Hmm?